From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Progressives can clearly articulate what we're fighting against. Poverty and racism, sexism and homophobia, wars, climate change, injustice in general. But what are we fighting for? In the 1990s and 2000s, the slogan, "Another world is possible," took hold. But today we seem further than ever from the ideal society we want. Now a new book is applying scientific and historical research to help answer the question of the kind of world we want to live in and how we can achieve it. The book has been written by my guest, Martin Shainhalls, an anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University. He's previously taught at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, and the University of Pennsylvania. His earlier books include The Paradox of Power and Intimate Exclusion. He joins me to discuss his newest book, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. Welcome to the program, Martin.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what exactly has driven you to write a book like this. The word utopia, unfortunately, is often used by the so-called pragmatists to dismiss those of us who are fighting for a better world, right?
It is. And I use the word quite intentionally, precisely for that reason, because I want to reclaim the word and the feelings that go along with it to say that not only can we critique the world as it is, but that we should offer bold alternatives and that there is, in fact, an alternative that's possible.
So those who subscribe to this idea that Darwinist, thoughts on evolution and Darwinist ideology on evolution can be applied to human societies today, you know, survival of the fittest, will justify how things work, will justify the hierarchies that we live in, will justify the fact that there seems to always be an underclass of oppressed as those who are the haves fight against the have-nots. But is that inevitable? And these are big questions, of course, that people who are like evolutionary biologists have tried to answer in the past. Is hierarchy, is a power difference and that unjust power dynamic between classes of humans inevitable because it's our nature?
Not at all. It is not only not inevitable, but when humans first appeared on Earth about 200,000 years ago in Africa, up until about 6,000 years ago, we lived as foraging people, which means that we got our food by hunting and gathering. We lived in small groups, we were very cooperative, and we lived with very little hierarchy. And this is not just a fantasy, this is a reality that has been documented carefully by anthropologists. And so what that means is that for 95% of humans' time on Earth, we have lived an egalitarian way of life. It happened in the past, and that shows that we have that capacity within ourselves currently.
Let's dig a little bit into those details, because you're right. It's something that has been written about, and sometimes the details have been glossed over. What sort of an egalitarian society has humanity existed in for 95% of its existence? Are we talking about egalitarianism that includes women? Are we talking about egalitarianism that includes, animals or nature?
So the answer is that, for example, on the issue of gender, most anthropologists consider that foraging people are the most egalitarian of all peoples, even more so than the most egalitarian societies that we might find in the contemporary world. And one of the important things about foraging peoples is that they had no concept of land ownership and no concept of real ownership in the way that we have it. And that's really important because that meant that there were no differences in terms of ownership of wealth. Also, one of the really important things to know is that as far as leaders go, the ideal leader had to be a humble person who would persuade others to follow him or her, and there were also female leaders, and they had to persuade rather than coerce. Anyone who was coercive or in any way arrogant, that person would face extreme ostracism and shaming from the group. You know, one of the things that is most looked down upon in small-scale foraging societies, but also even in small-scale agricultural societies, like one of the ones in rural China that I studied, what's most looked down upon is the person who's arrogant and who's not generous. And so this is the reality of humans and our capacity and our desire to live as egalitarians.
So let's talk about that research that you did in China that I understand was in part the basis of an earlier book that you wrote. What was that research and how did it inform the book that you have just released, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia?
So I am referring to my work among the Yi people. The Yi are an ethnic minority group in China who live in the high mountains. They're subsistence agriculturalists. And they have a kind of informal leader who is not voted on or otherwise selected, but kind of informally looked up to. And the things that that person most needed would be a kind of temperament that was very generous, very giving, and very fair, because those leaders, their prime responsibility was to share with other people and also to negotiate ends to conflict. And this is something that holds not only among the Yi people, but among many, many small-scale societies studied by anthropologists. It's only really with the rise of what are called civilizations, but we as anthropologists hesitate to call them civilizations, but the civilizations we're all familiar with. It's only at that time that you get hierarchy. And even then, there are various kinds of checks on the hierarchy.
So what was it about these quote-unquote civilizations that created that turning point in human history where we find ourselves in this, you know, deeply unequal society, unjust society? Are we talking about the advent of weaponry or industrial agriculture or capitalism or slavery or all of the above?
Just about all of the above. So what this is, the origins of hierarchy are debated and theorized by anthropologists, and it's not known for sure how it all came about, because 6,000 years ago, there was no written history documenting how hierarchy was happening. But what one of the most popular theories, and one that I'm convinced has a lot of reason to it, is that there started to be, with property, with agriculture, there started to be property, and with property, people in certain regions, usually the prosperous ones, the river valleys like in Mesopotamia or the Nile, certain groups started to raid other groups either for animals or for land. And warfare led to conquest, and conquest led to slavery. And so most anthropologists believe that the very first hierarchy was due to the enslaving of conquered peoples. And that had all kinds of repercussions as well for women, because male warrior groups were formed that based themselves around a kind of notion of the kinship of the male group and the outsiderness of women.
So before we get to actually envisioning that utopian society, I want to address this question of human nature. I mean, if you're suggesting that for 95% of our existence, we didn't give in to our baser nature, then maybe I've already answered my question. But there are many who would suggest, you know, in the vein of Ayn Rand's work, that we are inherently selfish people, that we are inherently, that we are our best when we act in our own selfishness. Is there any truth or any scientific basis for some of those claims?
No, not really. I mean, obviously, humans can be very hierarchical under certain circumstances, and that's my reason for writing the book, is that under the right circumstances, the kind of better part of our capacities, the egalitarian nature, the sharing nature, can come to the fore. But we survived, humans, from 200,000 years ago through to 10,000 years ago in a very harsh environment and with very difficult circumstances. And one of the things that made us survive was the fact that we shared within the group. Had we not done that, had we not been helpful to each other, humans as a species most likely would not have survived. So our nature, as it has been documented by anthropologists, is not an Ayn Rand human nature, but a very different one. And it's only within the last 5% of human history that we have acted with slavery and with hierarchy. And so that distorts the way that we think about human nature.
But isn't the genie out of the bottle now? I mean, can we not, can we really put it back the way it was? Ought we to even think of it in those terms when we want to undo the damage of, you know, the last several centuries and return to that idealistic society, or at least more egalitarian society? Are we talking about going backward or forward?
We are not talking about going backward, and I realize it's a very good question. It's one that my students often ask me. They will all say, do you think that we want to return to a forager time, because they like their cell phones and other things like that? And I'm not advocating that. In fact, one of the things that's very true about humans is that we're very flexible. And even in the worst circumstances of human society that we see in the 20th century and the 21st century, there are all kinds of people doing really often unnoticed, very compassionate sorts of things. And so I'm not being Pollyanna-ish. I'm not denying by any means the horribleness of the 20th century and continuing into the 21st century. All kinds of awful things that humans have done to each other. But what I'm saying is there are reasons that we act that way. And if those social formations are changed, we can act in a very different way.
So let's talk about how we envision work, and because that's part of your the first part of your subtitle, work, love, and learning. So work is the topic of so much discussion these days, especially in the United States. Workers are striking. Many who are caught up in the gig economy are struggling, and yet we're told unemployment is at its lowest rates ever. So what are we complaining about? This idea of work, what role it plays in our lives, and what we deserve, what our rights are when we think about work, are big questions. How should we envision the role of work in our utopian society?
Well, I think that for starters, the fact that work is so much a part of our lives and our identities, it's always really, really puzzled me why people don't talk about the ways to make work more enjoyable and to make it enjoyable in a kind of voluntaristic sense. And so one of the things that is central to my utopia, although it's by no means the only element, but it's an important element, is to guarantee the basics of subsistence to all people so that no one has to work, so that we work because we want to do so, not because we're made to do so by someone with greater authority than us. And I think that's that issue of kind of distribution of subsistence to all people and a changing way of thinking about work is something that we rapidly are going to have to face. You know, in the 20th century, so many people were farmers up until the 1920s, I think, in the United States, about half of all people were farmers. And as agricultural efficiency increased, the number of people who could be employed as farmers plummeted. And the same thing, of course, has happened with industry. I grew up in the Detroit area, and so I've seen that very much, that with the automation of much of the auto industry, large numbers of people have been put out of work. It's true that the official unemployment rate is now low, but as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, the unemployment rate that usually that's quoted does not include those who have given up looking for work because they're discouraged, and it doesn't consider whether people are earning enough money in a particular work. And so I'm sure you know, as I know, so many people who are working in the gig economy, not because they want to, but because they can't get other work. They're not earning enough. They're not earning enough at a job that is consonant with their abilities and their desires. And so there's something strange about that, that as the world gets more efficient, theoretically, that we accept or seem to accept the idea that we all have to live with less and less money and less salary, unless we're at the very top. There's no reason that has to be true.
So in our utopian world, do you envision what people are talking about now more and more openly, this idea of a universal basic income, for example?
Yes, exactly. And I'm so pleased to see the Democratic candidates talking about a basic income guarantee. Some of them are talking about various kinds of full employment bills or full employment guarantees. These are things that we haven't talked about in the United States, at least, since the 1970s. And I don't know why we haven't talked about them, because anyone looking around at what's happening, for example, the origins or the coming of autonomous driving vehicles, there are several million people who make a living driving vehicles, and they in short order will be put out of work. And of course, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. And what I'm arguing is it's precisely a good thing. If the drudge labor that most of us don't want to do doesn't exist, that's a virtue. And that's something that we should take advantage of by using that time that all of us will then have for creative exploits. For
as
me,
long
the,
as our needs are taken care of. Right.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so, you know, I know that there are lots of people who will say that the idea of giving basic subsistence needs to people who don't work will encourage laziness or all kinds of things. But, you know, it used to be the case that children worked, and we now accept the idea that children should not work, and yet we don't divorce them from subsistence needs because they don't work. We fully accept the idea that children should be housed and fed, although, of course, the United States doesn't do a good job with all children doing that. But the notion, nonetheless, that work and subsistence necessarily have to be linked is an artificial one, and one that hasn't even existed at all times in history, and certainly won't exist in the near future.
And we know in our society today that those who want to engage in creative work are only able to if they're already privileged. The worlds of creativity and art are often dominated by the independently wealthy because they don't have to worry about earning a living, whereas those who struggle to make it into those creative fields are, you know, that the idea of the starving artist is very much real. It's becoming more and more true now of academics as well. So-called adjunct faculty in universities around the country are often being paid poverty-level wages. And so, you know, certainly there is a great desire, right, among humans to engage in creative work if we only had the means to do so. And it could create a much richer society for us.
Yes, exactly. There is absolutely no reason why we couldn't have a society in which that's the case. I document clearly and carefully in the book that the world is capable of producing more than enough food. There are all kinds of inefficiencies in, for example, food waste. And So I carefully document the idea that scarcity does not have to be the condition under which we all live. And in fact, there's no reason that the starving artists and the now starving academics that you refer to need to starve. We can and should give the basics of a reasonable life to all people. That's not a strange idea, of course, even as far as adults. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt was very instrumental in writing. And so I'm calling upon us doing that, and in so doing, to allow that person who is a starving artist to not only eat, but also to be able to have the time to create. And then the other thing is to have an audience to appreciate his or her creations. I think a really good economy is one that provides an audience, and I'm using audience in a kind of metaphoric way, for all of our creations. I'm sure you know, as I do, so many people who spend so much time working on art and doing so many things and not getting any recognition for it. And that's a real tragedy and a real waste in human happiness. And there's no reason for that to happen.
Let's talk about the learning part of the book that you write about. There's so much discussion about here in the U.S., especially about how our educational system is broken in terms of the kinds of values that kids learn, but how they're taught as well. And then when they do graduate, how they're able to live or have access higher education and then choose between going to debt versus not. Our system of learning is clearly broken as well. How could it look if we were to put our minds to it?
So just as with work, I want to inject a discussion of the pleasure and the joy into the way that we think about work. I want to do the same with learning. It's always really shocked me that in all of the discussions about learning, very, very rarely are the pleasures of learning discussed. Or if they're discussed, they're discussed as something that's still instrumental, something that will make kids want to learn more. But ultimately, the goal of learning is always said to be for national glory and individual prosperity. And I think that's a real tragedy too, because I see so often, having taught many different ages of students, the kind of anxiety that puts students under. And it's an anxiety that is unnatural. Kids, when we're very young, we all love to learn. It's the human legacy, the desire to learn and the joy in learning. And school somehow has a way of almost always crushing that desire because it's coerced, because it's instrumental, and because the joys and the pleasures of learning aren't recognized. So I want to return school to a kind of situation that's more like the way that we are when we're young. You know, learning our mother tongue is one of the most difficult feats cognitively. And it's something that we learn not because someone is dangling grades or money or anything else in front of us. It's something that we learn as kids kind of automatically because of the joys of wanting to communicate. And we do it within a social context. And for me, that's a good model for how learning should be.
And then there's love. Love is something that's considered deeply personal. Unfortunately, our government has gotten involved, particularly when it comes to the rights of same-sex couples to love one another. And of course, love is what also inherently makes us human, our ability to love. Although, you know, of course, we may not know how animals love one another or what love even means outside of the human realm, but certainly it seems to be something that makes us uniquely human. What can love look like in a utopian society?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because so often people who are progressive, we talk about either the economy or we talk about relationships and gender and love, but we don't talk about both. And I think that we need to talk about both, about all of them, work, love, and learning. And love should be as egalitarian as work. And I think that there is no reason that we can't seek a society in which there's equality of love and attention to all people in many of the same ways that we would seek equality of wealth. And what I envision by that is that there will be a media that will be devoted to portraying the stories of average people. You know, right now, the media usually obsesses on celebrities. There's a cult of the celebrity, and everyone else gets ignored. And so what I envision is a media that would specifically do the life histories and the stories of average people. This is something that anthropologists do anyway, and so it's kind of a professional point of pride on my part to say that we should have a media that does this, to tell the stories of remote people, of people who are neglected, and by doing that, to give attention to those people who often don't get it. And by doing that, I'm seeking to kind of challenge the hierarchy that exists in the world of love and romance, the hierarchy that says that there are only certain people worthy of attention, certain people who are worthy of being considered attractive. That needs to be challenged.
So the all-important question, which we should certainly discuss, is how do we get there, right? Because it's one thing to envision it, even if it's something that we say is possible, but to actually get there, doesn't that require sustained and dedicated grassroots efforts and activism to demand that not only are all of these utopian ideals possible, but that we deserve them and that we ought to have them now?
Yes, exactly. Well, that is a very challenging question you ask, but one very important part to me of getting there is for us to talk about the alternatives and to reject the Thatcher's notion that there is no alternative. There is, in fact, an alternative, and one that can be very pragmatic as well as idealistic, as I describe in the book. So what I'm hoping with the book is to get people to discuss, and to discuss in groups, to discuss how things could be different, to start to imagine a different kind of society, a different way of thinking about work, a different way of thinking about learning and love. And in so doing, to start to change from that kind of apathetic and despairing feeling that we can't change anything, that nothing will change, to a feeling of hope and possibility.
We haven't talked about climate and climate change, and I'm wondering if you've written about this, because, you know, all of these technological advances that we do enjoy today, that do result in, you know, transportation and technology and us being able to have cell phones and access to information are also things that are unfortunately killing our atmosphere and potentially threatening our own human existence. Is a utopian ideal that you write about in your book consistent with a world where we don't have an unstable climate?
Yes, it's perfectly consistent with the I know that all of your listeners will easily know that there's so much money and kind of a corruption of what the U.S. should be doing by the fossil fuel industry. And in a society that has egalitarian distribution of wealth and no money and a kind of collective ownership of natural resources, that will help to provide an impetus to change to other sources of energy. You know, the technologies are there and they're constantly being improved upon. And that's a piece of what I would advocate as well for utopia. A very important piece is that kind of care of animals and care of the natural resources be part of that utopia. And so if the hierarchical piece and the ownership piece changes, then we can act in ways that are much more sensible.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Martin. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Martin Shane Halls, anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University. He previously taught at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, and UPenn. His earlier books include The Paradox of Power and Intimate Exclusion. And we've been talking about his newest book called Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and our video channel on Vimeo. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Martin.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great talking.